This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, the podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Tuul Mende, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Masha Kirasirova, Margaret Litwin, and Eileen Kane about their new book, Russian Arab Worlds, a Documentary History, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Maybe we can start with the question about that you tell us a bit about yourself and how did you come to the place where you are now. Maybe we can start with you, Masha.
Sure. I'm happy to. So I guess how did I get here? I came into graduate school thinking I was going to study Middle Eastern history. And I was going to work on Syrian history, and then in part because of the outbreak of the Syrian civil war, my first research project became impossible, and I couldn't do that research. So I ended up going to the Soviet Union because I knew Russian to look for traces of Arab visitors and students and intellectuals there. So that's kind of where my origin of, you know, of interest in Russian Arab connections originated. And so I've been working in this field historically for a while, and that is how I came across Margaret on this very small circuit of Russian Arab. I guess at that point it was so small we were doing historical and literary studies connections together. And so we started doing conferences together, and it kind of snowballed into this wonderful collaboration with Eileen. This after a workshop that Margaret organized at Boston University in 2017. So we've been thinking about this both, you know, individually, but also collectively over many years. And, you know, so I'm really happy to finally have this. And I've also been teaching these connections and struggling with how to teach them for a while, and using some of these translated sources myself in the classroom. And so it was a nice opportunity to kind of get together and make this available for other people to use and I use it. I'm planning to use this now. So who am I? I'm a assistant professor of history at New York University in Abu Dhabi, which is a small liberal arts college where I teach mostly, you know, students coming from the global South and, you know, and a lot of students from the Arab world with a lot of interest in the experiences of Arabs, Arab voices, right? So I think for me, at least, this project and the source book will makes a lot of sense as a tool, especially where I am kind of in my institutional and intellectual life. So that's it.
Thank you so much, Masha. And what about you, Margaret?
Me? So I am, I guess, a literary historian. I teach Arabic literature and world literature at Boston University. And My first book was on Arabic adaptations and rewritings of Shakespeare's Hamlet. So basically, I'm a historian of modern Arabic literature and its global entanglements. And in the course of that Hamlet book, I noticed that one of the most important global entanglements was with Russian culture and Soviet culture. And I couldn't understand why my informants in Cairo were quoting the same Shakespeare films and plays and the same novels that were important to my parents in the Soviet Union in the 1960s and early 70s. And so I started exploring this. Like Masha, I grew up in a Soviet emigre family in the Boston area. And it was kind of delightful for my second project to return to these Soviet roots that I had never done anything with professionally. And I started finding more and more connections and doing research for what is a monograph I hope to finish up soon, called something like Red Mecca, The Life and Afterlives of the Arab-Soviet Romance. So this source book, this documentary history book with Masha and Eileen, is a chance for me to expand those interests beyond the binary connection between, you know, some Arab context and some Soviet context into all the borderlands in between that Eileen is so expert at. And also to expand the chronological scope, because our documentary history book goes 1772 to present, way out of my field, fishing totally without a license and pretending to be a historian. So it's been really fun.
Thank you so much, Margaret. And Eileen, can you tell us a bit about yourself too?
Sure. I'm going to start my story in the 90s. I should say also I'm the odd person out here because I'm not a native Russian speaker. I was not born in the Soviet Union. And so it's very rare to find people who work on Russia and the Middle East, especially Russia and the Arab world, and who know Russian and Arabic. So I have very basic Arabic, but I was so excited to meet these two colleagues who've become dear friends and co-conspirators in all kinds of ways. So my story starts in the 90s, I would say, with the collapse of the Soviet Union. I graduated from college in 94. So I was studying, I actually was in Moscow studying the year that the Soviet Union collapsed, 91 to 92. I was at Moscow State. And so like two things are important here. One is that living in the dorm at Moscow State, I was like, this did not look like a dorm at Brown University where I was an undergrad. You know, there was like all these people from the socialist world, you know, a whole floor of students from Cuba, a whole floor of students from Vietnam. And then in a Tolstoy class, I had a guy next to me who was writing, you know, he's dressed in a suit, you know, we're all in our jackets and boots, and he was very sort of dressed up and taking notes in Arabic. And I was just like, I had no context for understanding why an Arab would be studying at a Soviet university. And the way Russian history was being taught then, it was really part of Europe, oriented towards Europe in connection with Europe. So this, of course, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was the discovery of the Soviet Union as an empire, as a multi-ethnic, multi-religious place. So I was just so excited about this. And most of the, you know, six of the 15 Soviet republics, it turns out, were Muslim majority, and mostly Turkic speaking. So the next stage is 95 to 97. I got a Fulbright and went to Istanbul to study migrations from the Russian Empire to Anatolia and, you know, parts of the Ottoman Empire. Living in Istanbul, of course, Turul, I'm not sure if you're from Istanbul, but you've certainly been there. If you're not,
yes,
are you?
Yes, I've been there.
Okay, yeah. So of course, the most wonderful, one of the most wonderful things about Istanbul is the Bosphorus. You know, dissecting the city, it's so beautiful, and you know, these ships would be going in and out, you know, passing one another with Cyrillic on this side. You know, all this the students that I was meeting there were studying the Ottoman Empire, never in relation, or Turkey, never in relation to Russia. And so it was very striking being in the city, just how like you could throw a stone and you'd be in, well, Bulgaria, but Ukraine, Russia, like the Black Sea was so close. So I was like, I know there are these connections, but there's no framework for, there hadn't been in my undergrad to to sort of get at them, to figure out what they were about, what they looked like. So fast forward to graduate school at Princeton, I really wanted to write a dissertation that would connect these two places, but also sort of get at like how they were connected. So I was drawn to pilgrimage, originally Orthodox pilgrimage. And then once I got into the archives, I found all this stuff that it seemed no one had ever read about the Hajj. So I shifted from Orthodox pilgrimage to the Hajj, and I wrote a book called Russian Hajj that was published in 2015. And in the back of my mind, I was like, okay, and now I'm going to study those Arab students, because that just fascinated me. I mean, nothing made a bigger impression on me during that year in Moscow than life in the dorm. So people kept coming to me, and I would say, oh, I want to do this project. They say, oh, someone's already working on that. Masha Kirasirova just wrote a dissertation about that. And so I was like, oh, you know, sometimes you think there's not enough room in the world for two of you to write on the same thing. But I was like, I have to meet this person. And then I read some interview. I think Orit Bashkin had done an interview with Margaret. And I was like, who is this person? She sounds so interesting. And then like, in my inbox comes an invitation to do this workshop that Margaret organized, Margaret and Masha organized 2017, I think, at BU. And, you know, then this like beautiful friendship was born. They said, okay, let's do something. And this was Margaret's idea, and it was really brilliant. Let's not do a co-edited volume. Let's do a source book. And I was like, a source book? Like, and it turned out to be just brilliant. And really the way to, because we thought, okay, we want to seed a new field, or we want to sort of draw the contours of what like this thing that I wished for after that year in Moscow, like a framework for starting to get at what these connections are and to write the history of connections between these two parts of the world. So that's my story.
Thank you so much for you all three to share with us the story. And let's start with Russian Arab worlds. You told about this a bit already, but the idea of the book emerged during the workshop, or how did the book emerge, and how did you come to work together basically?
So as Masha and Eileen already said, in 2017 it was going to be the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, and in the good old Soviet tradition of celebrating anniversaries and using them as occasions for big cultural productions, I organized a really fun conference at Boston University where we rounded up basically everybody we knew who was working on anything remotely in this field. And it ranged from graduate students to very senior and maybe even emeritus people, native speakers of Russian, of Arabic, of Turkish, of English. It was a very diverse room. The novelist Alexandra Shreitach joined us and did a reading from her book, Ali and His Russian Mother, which is a wonderful short comic novel about the predicament of post-Soviet identity in Lebanon. And then out of this, we got the idea to publish original documents because translation is such a service. People needed materials for teaching. They needed a framework. And we didn't want to just put out a set of articles that nobody would read. And then there started this process where I thought it was going to be a very simple book to put together. And Eileen said, right, but who do we have writing about the Armenians? And I said, what Armenians? And she said, no, but you know, if you're studying Russian-Arab connections, Armenia is right there. And it turned out we had to find people. We found this wonderful contributor, Ara Sanjan in Michigan, who wrote us two beautiful chapters about, the second one was on how the Armenian Foreign Ministry, because there was one in the Soviet period, coordinated its Soviet internationalism, its outreach to Arab countries, by offering scholarships to Lebanese Armenians to come be Armenian in Yerevan. So they were using this internationalist infrastructure for nationalist goals, essentially. And his earlier chapter was even more fascinating. It was on the so-called repatriation of Armenians from Arab countries to their so-called homeland in Soviet Armenia, where they had never been and where they didn't realize they'd be living under Stalin. So as we worked on the book, every contributor we found opened up yet more questions and yet more kind of hungers and curiosities. And we didn't finish. We just at some point stopped.
Thank you so much. And there are a lot of material and documents in the book. How did you choose the documents? Did you had any criteria on how to choose them, or in what way did they ended up in the book?
So the criterion, I guess, the one I can think of that we stuck with was from the beginning was that it should be something that hasn't already been published in English. So this part of the service of the book is to take things that people otherwise couldn't read and give them beautiful translations and contextualizations in English. So I would think of it more as, it wasn't like, here's a topic and you put a call out and you get all these documents and you choose. We actually, it was kind of harder and funner than that, like finding people who might be able, and then sometimes saying, hey, you know, I'm not a specialist in what you do, but I do know about this. And could you write about, I know that I had this wonderful student at the time, Zbida Demirjan. She was my undergraduate, my student here at Connecticut College. And she told me about, she's Armenian, and her whole village being moved from Musuda by the French to, it's called Anjar. It's in Lebanon. I was like, okay, so we need to find someone who can write about the Armenians. So from her, I found this out, who can write about the Armenians in Lebanon. It took a while. And then, it was also like going into these little fields where, Armenian studies, Jewish studies, these are sort of like small self-contained fields. So I crowdsourced it on Facebook because most of my friends are scholars. And Lerna Ekmekciolo helped me by saying, I have a friend who teaches at the University of Michigan Dearborn and he writes on this. So long story short, we got connected with Ara Sanjan and, lots and lots of, I felt like I was sort of, could you please write for this source book? And so it was a lot of like chasing or discovering people who were writing often in very small, so-called small fields that were doing this amazing work that deserved a broader audience and had implications. I mean, whoever thinks of the Soviet Union as an immigrant destination. Large numbers of Armenians after World War II invited by Stalin immigrating to Armenia. None of that, according to what we know, should have been happening. So I would say they had to not have been published in English before, but it was a lot of the work we did was finding people and saying, I know you have this cool stuff, or I know you know something about this. Wouldn't you like to write something for this book? And persuading them. And I think we persuaded just about everyone. We were able to rope in. I don't know that anyone turned us down once we talked about what we were doing. So that part of it was just amazing and fun.
And about the contributors, did they approach you too as well? Or were most of the time you the person who approach them to get involved with the book?
So we did a roundtable at the ACES conference in 2018, talking about this book very optimistically, as though it were on the cusp of appearing, which it was not by any stretch. And out of the woodwork at that conference jumps Sergei Salyushev with the question, you wouldn't be interested in material from the Gestan, would you? We're like, oh my God, yes. What do you have? And he said, well, I was just in the archives and I found this slave sale document from 1864, 3 years after serfdom was abolished in the Russian Empire. And it's written in Arabic and it's a deed of sale of this female slave who is about a meter and a half tall. So she's a child. between, you know, a Muslim seller and a Muslim buyer in the North Caucasus. And it's notarized in Russian by a czarist notary, and it has the double eagle imperial seal on it. You wouldn't be interested in that for the book, would you? And so obviously we were very interested, and we were able to reprint a photo of the thing in the book, as well as, you know, maps explaining where these places are, and the translation, which was actually done by Sergei with a colleague. So they translated the Arabic and the Russian. Again, to show, so some people came flying at us from unexpected directions with really beautiful contributions, and other people we tracked down, we heard an interesting paper at a conference, and, you know, went running after the presenter. Masha tracked down Isabella Ginor and Gideon Remez. Our one criterion for the book was that every chapter has to challenge a received truth or wisdom in the field, in its respective field. And so, yeah, Masha can tell you more about Gideon and Isabella's contribution. But basically, anytime we heard anything surprising or unexpected that surprised us, we tried to find it and rope it in. And then Oxford said, okay, you're at 400 pages, maybe enough.
Do you want to add on this, Masha, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think the process of selecting people was very fun, and it was some of the most fun research, I think, that I've done. It was also the one time I've done research, I felt like, as part of a collective. And it was sort of a project of like, what is this collective and how do we expand it? And in what ways do we want to expand it? And sometimes it was serendipitous in the ways that Margaret described. Sometimes it was deliberate, like we thought a lot about what the gaps were. And it, clearly we didn't cover all of the gaps, because people keep asking us like, well, what about Yemen? Or, you know, what there, you know, what about other kinds of connections? And but I think there's definitely a lot of just us talking about what the gaps that we wanted to fill were, and how would we do it, and who do we know that could possibly do it. So, and it was definitely a way of like, let us expand this group together. And yeah, so I guess that was part of the research, and it was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. And while reading Russian Arab Worlds, I thought about how maybe the current landscape of this particular research field looked like. Can you tell us about how this book engages with this field in general?
Yeah, and I guess just to follow up on what I was just saying, I mean, I think one of the nice things about this volume and our group as editors is the interdisciplinarity, which I think is what is so effective in breaking down these silos between Soviet, Russian, Eurasian, and Middle Eastern fields. And I mean, I think this is something that's, you know, an inevitable product of our editorial team, right? Margaret's a professor of Arabic literature. Eileen and I are both historians with training in Russian, Soviet, Middle Eastern fields. And I think a lot of the conferences that Margaret and I were doing before this and workshops were, I was always on panels with literary scholars, like it was Rosen Jagalov, Katie Clark was sometimes in the mix, Artemy Kalinowski. There was a whole group of people that we would meet, and we had a lot to discuss, even though we were in different disciplines of literary and historical studies. And I think that's one of the nice things that we ended up doing with this collective, is to bring together literary scholarship, Middle Eastern, Soviet, and global history, mostly political and intellectual, but also we have studies of visual culture in here. And actually one of the inspirations I remember at the 2017 workshop for us, or for me, was Val Kivelson's and Joan Nuremberger's Picturing Russia source book, which I've used in my teaching, you know, and although, and it's so easy to use in teaching, the length, you know, and most of the sources that we have are are logocentric. There are state documents, like Margaret was saying, the sales deed. Sometimes they're autobiographical or literary. But we also have some visual contributions. Like we have a photo essay by the artist scholar Ala Yunus about Yusuf Shaheen's two films about the Aswan Dam, one from 1968 and one from 1970. And she writes about how Shaheen shot footage of the High Dam for a fictional film in 1964. He advised Nasser on when to push the button or the most telegenic moment to do so. But then after he completed the film in 1968, it was after the war and Egyptian and Soviet authorities rejected it for being too ideologically ambiguous. So he had to re-edit and create a new film. And the old one sat in the archives until 1990. And so Ala Yunus is able to talk about all of these, how these images, what they say about post-colonial Egyptian internationalism, kind of the infrastructure of aid, censorship in the film industry. But it also, because she's an artist, it speaks to contemporary art's response to all of these topics, right? We also have images from the art historian Suheyla Takesh, who has a wonderful entry about the Iraqi painter Mahmoud Sabri, who studied at Surikov Art Institute. But he's part of a larger context of foreign students that are studying in these programs. And this is the subject of another entry by Konstantin Katsakioris with fabulous data. And you can see in this these are very different fields. One is, visual analysis. The other is kind of very computational history, but they speak to each other very directly. And then, from the visual source, you have, Suheyla's discussion of how Sabri's master's painting techniques, but how he often clashes with his teacher over interest in applying these techniques to themes like martyrdom and civil strife, which are awkward ideologically for the Soviet Union. So it gets a lot more into the kind of the ambiguity of the content. But then you have other sources that provide context for this. There are other sources about educational exchanges. That is a major theme that runs throughout the book. And it, in a way, I think that's one of the contributions is the connections between the disciplines that the sources show. And I think that's what makes it so, I don't think there's like one particular, it's hard to pin down what field this book really sits in. And I think that's kind of that's the nice thing about curating this collective and being, and being open to all of these different, serendipitous and kind of deliberate choices that we made together during the pandemic. So
I just want to jump in and add. So Masha has just talked about how the book breaks down artificial boundaries between disciplines. And I want to say we're trying to do the same thing with area studies fields. And break down artificial divisions of space, literally with a new set of maps that illustrates the spaces we're talking about and the movement of people, ideas, and goods across those spaces. And also intellectually, just by studying it, we make the somewhat grandiose claim that we're mapping out a new field of Arab-Russian studies, but we are not trying to reify the Arab world or reify the Russian world, God forbid, Ruski Mir. And we are instead, by showing these particular connections and passages, trying to lay out a model for how to approach area studies differently in a seriously transregional way.
Thank you so much. And were there any cases that you had documents that could be in the book but were needed to be left out, maybe because of the space or anything? So were there any cases that you could include more material in the book?
I don't remember feeling like there was something, this sounds sort of new agey, but like, I feel like we knew kind of, well, Margaret did mention that we were not allowed to publish 400 pages. So we could have probably gone on and on and on. But, you know, we spent 5 years working on this, and it just sort of seemed to kind of come to a natural end. Margaret, you found this beautiful piece to end, you know, this writer, Khalil El-Rez's The Russian Quarter. Once you produced that, it was like, yes, that is a good way to end. And I think this work we did on maps, we spent so much time just getting everything right and getting the names right. And, you know, these truly were, and I'd done a bit of this with my book on the Hajj because there weren't maps that I could just recreate from other books. So I think making those maps too, I think helped us kind of bring things to a close because it was like, okay, we have really mapped out the territories that we're talking about geographically. And then we leave these, I could just look at them and the questions that they conjure up. So they themselves are kind of have arguments implied in them or invite questions. So making the maps, we did that towards the end. I think that helped feel like, okay, we could see like a hole that we had like W-H-O-L-E, that we had created and it was time to finish it. So it wasn't, I don't remember thinking, saying we really want, you know, like Taylor Swift has these new songs out from the vault, you know, like my daughter listens to. It's like, oh, these didn't make it into the album and now they're great and selling. We didn't have like stuff in the vault that couldn't make it in. We, right? Am I remembering correctly, you guys?
I mean, there's an infinite amount of stuff that we would have wanted to include. The book is more a proof of concept in my mind than a totality. Of course, there's stuff on... We start in 1772 with the earliest European intervention, military intervention in the Eastern Mediterranean, like 25 years before Napoleon. It turns out to be the Russian Navy. And we don't have anything from the Arabic perspective on that. We don't have Zahir al-Omar about that uprising and about how a Palestinian independence movement from the Ottomans would have wanted to make use of the Russians. We could have had much more on the roots of the Soviet relationship with Syria. As Masha mentioned, Yemen is a gap. There's an infinite number of gaps because, again, what we've done is to open up a question, and that question makes you look at things and say, well, what about this? There was a beautiful piece of research that we weren't able to include about Arabs with the last name Abaza receiving Russian passports in Abkhazia, and what that kind of extraterritoriality could be used for or what it could mean. Once you're looking at the world through the lens of this kind of connection, everything lights up in a different way.
Thank you. And while you did the work on the documents and translating parts of it, what kind of difficulties did you come across while working on them? Were there any particular difficulties that you can think of?
The first thing is just the languages. As I mentioned, many chapters are co-authored by people with different language sets. And I think for transregional research, this is something to take seriously. It's not always going to be a solo project. Mm-hmm. Nobody has all the languages. And so there's a lot of pairs. And then how to translate each work in the style appropriate to it. So if it's a literary work, it needs a literary translation. If it's a report on Russia exporting kerosene to the Persian Gulf, it needs a more straightforward literal translation. How to render terminology appropriately, like in the Comintern documents that Masha translated, to capture the style and the flavor of the period. And yeah, how to be flexible enough that all those different translation styles could exist in a book, but you could still imagine reading the book straight through somehow.
Thank you so much. And as already mentioned earlier, you work all in different kind of fields. How does Russian Arab worlds fit in your own research? And is it kind of connected to you, the projects that you are working on next, or how does it fit into your own work?
I guess I can start. So for me, I've been working on these connections for a long time, and this was the subject of my dissertation and book, which just came out last month. It's called The Eastern International Arabs, Central Asians, and Jews in the Soviet Union's Anti-Colonial Empire. And it's that monograph traces a chronologically smaller set of connections between Soviet Orientalists, mostly Arabists, Arab communists and leftists, and other representatives of Soviet Eastern cultural intelligentsia. And so this, I guess, this project really helped me. I guess it made me realize, first of all, that there is a community of people, you know, that is ready to think about these connections and take them seriously, and also to collectively try to make the kinds of interventions to, I guess, look at these fields of Middle Eastern and Soviet history that have, I guess, been taught to me and still in a relatively Eurocentric way in graduate school, and are just now starting to shift, and people are, you know, I think they're actually running to look to other kinds of directions and connections. And we see that from graduate students, from all sorts of young scholars that are writing dissertations, and that's also very exciting. I mean, it's also, you were asking about what did we leave out. I mean, there have been people that I've come across since that are working on these topics that I thought, wow, you could have easily been in a book like this, or you are an interlocutor, you are part of this this kind of collective research interest direction. And I guess so. It was really nice to have that kind of connection between the monograph and this collective project. And also for me, because I'm at a liberal arts college, for me, pedagogy is a big part of my work and my research. And so I think this source book goes a long way to helping me think about my research with my students. You know, I'm excited to use it. I'm teaching Russia in the World class in the fall. I'm definitely going to be using the source book for that. And so I'm looking forward to continuing to think about these connections and also build out and consider others in the classroom. And for me, that is also a kind of research.
Thank you so much.
Should I go next and then you can have the last word, Eileen?
Sure.
Yeah, so for me, the material in this book and the research leading up to this book and the people I've met through this editing process have given me just a wealth of material to cite and to lean on in my own work, which is, as I mentioned, literary history more. Although I'm also talking about those Soviet dorms in the monograph I'm finishing now on the Arab-Soviet romance, definitely the kitchens, bedrooms, and bathrooms, especially of those dormitories, are a lasting interest to me. And I do translate a piece about bathrooms in the documentary history book by this refrigeration engineer from Egypt who's just horrified at the filth of Soviet toilet hygiene, or lack of it, kind of the toilet as an intercultural contact zone. So I'm hoping to finish up that monograph leaning heavily on the historical context that we've laid out in this much larger project. For instance, I can mention the Imperial Orthodox Palestine Society schools, knowing that we have personally geolocated using a 1907 survey, all 102 of them in obscure villages throughout Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine, some of which unfortunately don't exist anymore, and we had to put them back on the map. I'm also working on a translation into English of Khalil al-Ruz's book, The Russian Quarter, which I have excerpts of as the last chapter in the documentary history book. And I'm excited to translate more of that. And it was very fun to interview Khalil and start that translation for this book.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
So I will say some similar things to what I think both Margaret and Masha said. I mean, this working on this book just helped me have more confidence in some ideas that were sort of preliminary at the beginning of it, and to sharpen them. And so I'm writing a book now. It doesn't have a title yet, but it's about making the point that you can't understand the history of the modern Middle East without including Russian and Soviet history. And those of us, you who teach modern Middle Eastern history, a survey course, you'll know that Britain is all over the place, France, but Russia really isn't. And so, one of the main points that I want to make in this book is the Knesset, the founding members of the Knesset. I mean, anyone who does Jewish studies or Israel studies knows this. It was predominantly emigres from the Russian Empire. The Young Turk movement, 5 out of the 14 founding members were emigres from the Russian Empire. So both of these things being foundational to the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, the creation of the new nation state of Turkey in 1923. Like, we kind of know it, but we never really say it. And I think that this might be a way to make a compelling case that there's so much more that we just need to include Russia when we talk about the Middle East. Like, I have colleagues who, yes, of course, there's, the State of Israel, it's been there since 1948. And yes, of course, there are Circassians in, Jordan, and there are some in Israel. But they are there because of this narrowing definition of who belongs in the Russian Empire as the 19th century goes on, late 19th century, well, really starting after the Crimean War, when you have the mass expulsion of different ethnic groups, Muslim populations from the Caucasus, almost 1 million people, and many of them end up in, Jordan, as I mentioned, the Circassians, and Anatolia. So it's both the leadership, I mentioned the Knesset and the Young Turk movement, sort of laid the foundations for Kemalist ideology. And it's also people, to sort of Turkify Anatolia. These people were sort of redefined as Turks, but they were from the Caucasus. And they, I sort of come back to this, most people don't want to leave home. They don't leave unless they have to. So, if we could trace a lot of these things that we're talking about today, these intractable conflicts, these, people being persecuted because they're minoritized in different places, we could start, say the source of this is in late 19th century Russia, when, you start to see pogroms and you see mass movement. My students are off, we could look at New York City too. There's just, of course it's a center of the Jewish world. It's a very Jewish city. Well, it wasn't until Russia started you know, there were economic reasons, of course, also, I mean, all parts of Europe were emptying out. But this is part of the story of Russia's increasingly discriminatory policy towards non-Christians and the sort of redefinition of who belongs in the Russian Empire and who can call themselves Russian. And I dare say that that's also of interest to us today because of the problems we're seeing with that being weaponized against the Ukrainians.
Oh my God, Eileen, hurry up and write this book. Sounds amazing.
Like Masha, I'm at a liberal arts college, so I spend a lot of my time, it's very pleasurable, but I spend a lot of time with students. So, but this summer, hopefully.
Thank you so much, everyone, for being on the podcast with me today and for sharing your knowledge with us. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.